The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
There's been a serious breach with tradition. Instead of the lies said in the introduction, before I speak, I'll just get up and speak. My name is Ian Powell. Welcome to CBF Legal. I'll speak for a few moments, probably a few moments too long, and then we'll have a brief question time, question and answer time, and we can hang around afterwards to converse together. As you know, if you got the email from us, and if you didn't get it, you might like to know so we can inform you of coming attractions. Anxiety is, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, Australia's leading area of mental unwellness, mental struggles. It is clearly on the increase. Joe just gave me an article from the Financial Review called Getting a Grip on Anxiety. It's about a program run by Beyond Blue, which is better known for its work in depression, but anxiety and depression, increasingly people realise that you can't speak about one without dealing with the other. And certainly from my friends who've worked in this area for many years, if you are anxious for long, you are very likely to develop depression. That's where the body seems to go with that. Anxiety is part of the fear spectrum. If you like, at one end there is dread, all the way across to an unsettledness, a dis-ease. Anxiety is normally understood not to be focused in one specific thing. It's just a sense that life is vulnerable. You might be well, you might be doing well financially, your relations might be intact, but you can still be struggling with an enormous amount of anxiety because any one of those areas can go wrong very, very quickly. So there are many things that rob us of the joy that really we should have. And often people who are feeling anxious or people trying to help those who are anxious remind them that, 95% of the people in the world would give anything to have the problems and the safety and the security that we have. But that doesn't seem to help. At a popular level, one of the things that people do when they're seeking for peace of mind, which I'm putting in a sense as the opposite of anxiety, we'll sometimes in our culture rush off to some sort of Buddhist-based seeking for peace. And at a popular level, you can see the Buddhist answer to the problems of anxiety is in that what I find a very irritating booklet that's got the famous saying in it, don't sweat the small stuff. Do you know what the next line is? Everything is small stuff. And I think that is an insulting nonsense. But I think it's fair to say that in the teaching of the Buddha, that is probably right. Everything is small. Nothing is real. Nothing is worth losing your peace of mind over. And in fact, that we do lose our peace of mind is an indication of our lack of enlightenment. If we could only see things properly, we would not be attached about nor concerned about these things. Jesus has his own answer to the problems of anxiety and the longing for peace, but I want to suggest to you that they are heading in the exact opposite direction to the Buddha. It is life-affirming, it is love-centered, it is person-centered, and I want to suggest to you it's fundamentally healthier. So in this chapter that we've got here in front of you, and we've typed it as small as possible, don't get anxious if you can't read it, it is very small, you're not losing your sight, and it's a massive section. We very rarely try to look at a passage this big. One of the things that's easy to miss, and one of the things that I'm appreciating more and more about Mark's gospel is, it looks like a fairly simple document thrown together. That, I think, is a mark of someone who's, like myself, is a tad superficial and hasn't noticed. So in Mark 4, as we looked at, we've got the teaching about the weird kingdom that God is bringing in. If you don't listen to him, you'll misunderstand it without a doubt. It's small, it's unimpressive, but it's going to be the biggest game in town. It is weak, it is vulnerable, but it is invincible. It is the smallest seed that will produce the largest plant. And we looked at that last week, even statistically. Then in this section, from the end of chapter 4, We have four stories, seemingly unrelated except that Jesus is in the center of all of them, and yet all dealing with the same basic issue, those things that destroy and challenge and kill our peace. So he's going to deal with the dangers of nature, which we very rarely feel in the city, but sometimes even in the city a hailstorm can damage our houses and our cars, etc. But for many people in the world, the savagery of nature is a great cause of fear and anxiety. Quite a bit of worship that humans have done over the years has been to try and tame or win the favour of those forces. Then we're going to look at Jesus dealing with deep, personal, vicious evil. Then Jesus dealing with two sorts of disease, in a sense. One is sort of the chronic disease that goes on and on forever, that just debilitates and robs you of life. And lastly, a short, acute disease and death. These great things that threaten us in many ways. We're going to chapter 6, but we won't go into chapter 6, where Jesus will then deal with three preachers, or Mark will. It's quite an extraordinarily neat gospel. And because he doesn't keep flashing what he's doing, you can miss it and just think, oh, this is story one. Here's another interesting story. But so we've got four stories of threats and power, then three stories of preachers, all of whom are rejects, all of whom are going to have difficulties. Jesus, the disciples, and then looking back to John the Baptist. Well, let's have a look at these threats. The first is Jesus and the storm. Let me read it to you. It's a terrific story, and it just happens to be true. That day, starting at the top of the left-hand side there, that day when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." The wind died down. It was completely calm. He said to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" But they were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Now, in all four of these stories, you could look at them as, if you like, under three headings. Firstly, an impossible problem. Then secondly, the unscripted Jesus. And thirdly, the difference he makes. So firstly, the impossible problem. They're in a boat. A number of the disciples, as you know, are professional fishermen. They're basically the only sort of sailors that the Jews had. The Jews were not a sailing people. They didn't like the ocean. But in the Sea of Galilee, Jews fished it. And it's a shallow lake. Because of the geography between Mount Hermon, which is quite a bit above sea level, and the Sea of Galilee, which is the lowest lake on the planet, it's below sea level, and the shape of the ravines, massive wind squalls can come down. And you can be on the lake and it'd be quite fun, and suddenly you get smashed by this squall. I've been once in a, not a rainy storm, but a sort of a wind storm on Jarvis Bay, and it was one of the two or three times in my little boat I've been really quite frightened. Not for me, but for my daughter who was in the front of the boat. And when we got back, we discovered that a Halvorsen cruise had been flipped over in Jarvis Bay just the week before. Shallows are quite dangerous. And so we've got professional sailors, professional fishermen, who are terrified in this storm. This is no ordinary storm. This is a furious squall. And they feel that they're in danger of dying. They're in danger of drowning. They see Jesus sleeping in the back of the boat, and they seem to get a bit incensed with this. They wake him up and say, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" It's an understandable accusation if you've got someone doing nothing when everyone else is panicking. Don't you care if we drown? I don't know what they expected Jesus to do. He didn't have any sort of CV when he met them, "I calm storms." There was no indication of anyone in the history of dealing with God who could calm storms except God himself, and the disciples had no reason to think Jesus was that. They knew he was a man. In fact, the proof of the fact he's a man is that he's completely knackered after a day's teaching and healing, and he's asleep, and that he's sleeping in quite a stormy situation. So he's very clearly a human who needs his rest. I guess they think, at least as a tradesman, as a carpenter, technon, as the word was, he presumably had good enough muscles to bail. I find him a little tinny, as the slow leak in it slowly lets the water in, the occasional wave gets over, most of my friends can bail and seem to be quite happy to do it. But Jesus gets up with this impossible situation and does something quite silly, really. He talks to the wind and talks to the waves. At which point, if I was the disciples, I think in that moment after the words came out, I think maybe his family were right, as we saw a couple of weeks ago. Maybe he has lost it. Maybe under the pressure he's had a psychological meltdown. It's an absurdity to speak to the wind and the waves. You can get someone like Obama, you can get the head of the UN, you can get the most powerful men and women in the planet all together and say in unison to the wind, be quiet or shut up. The words are quite a strong word. It's a word, be muzzled. So he talks very, you know, sternly to the wind and very sternly to the waves. It's an act of foolishness, but suddenly absolute calm, a dead calm. Now, the wind could be a coincidence, couldn't it? The Fonz occasionally gets lucky with things when he speaks the word. The wind could be a coincidence. You know anything about the oceans, the seas can't be. Long time after the wind is gone, the waves are still nasty. Storm can pass by the east coast down near New Zealand. The waves will be pumping through the heads for quite some days afterwards. But that the wind is silent could be coincidence. That the waves are gone, no coincidence. Jesus then turns to the disciples and gives quite a helpful either or here. He says to them, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? He does seem to see, as the NA and AA big book says, that the measure of your distance from God is your anxiety. He says, why? Fear as against faith is what Jesus seems to put up there. So he says, boys, where's your faith? Why didn't you trust me? In a remarkably bit of interesting storytelling, which I think is obviously based on a memory, verse 41. In the story, if you were a half-decent storyteller, you'd have them being happy, but they're not happy. They are terrified. They've gone from being fearful to mega fearful. They feared with a great fear is what Mark says literally. It's really emphatic that they've gone from being frightened of the storm. It's a complete dead calm. They're not about to drown. What are they frightened of? Well, you can see it from the text, can't you? They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. See, one of the ways that you can deal with your fears is by pretending it doesn't matter, pretending death doesn't frighten you. Or the other way is to have someone more powerful with you who you know can actually deal with that thing which threatens you and that you can't. The difference Jesus makes is he takes them from fear to terror, which isn't exactly what you want, but I think actually through fear to terror to peace would be the way forward. But they ask the question because no man has that power. Moses didn't have that power. None of the great prophets had that power. No one has the power to speak to the wind and the waves. As good Jewish boys, they would know from Psalm 107, in which is the section which the mariners use. Some went down to the ships. And it is God alone who can say to the wind and the waves, hush, be still. It's one of the law of the duck that I think Mark and the Gospels use. People who are unsubtle in their use of literature and understanding of how you can educate people, they want Jesus to say, I am God. Which would have been oh so persuasive, wouldn't it? I mean, that's how you persuade someone. Make an outrageous claim. The way in which Jesus does it is the law of the duck. If it waddles like a duck, if it swims like a duck, if a duck dies like a duck, if it tastes like a duck, if it flies like a duck, what is it? It's a flipping duck. Right? And that's how Jesus pushes people to the absurd notion that he's not just human, but is divine. He does the things that only God can do. He calms the seas. So there is one of the great terrifying forces of the world that causes fear and anxiety that we cannot deal with. He then deals with the question of savage evil. Jesus does lots of exorcisms. Here is a guy with thousands of evil spirits. He is a guy who is getting progressively worse. We're told in chapter 5 that in verse 3, this man lived in the tombs. No one could bind him anymore. There obviously was a time when they could bind him and tie him up, but not anymore. He is growing in power, not even by chains. They chained him up in the tombs. Did they chain him up to protect him from himself? Because we read later on he's cutting himself. He's doing terrible self-damage? Or did they chain him up to protect themselves and their children? Or both? This man is a terrible picture of what evil is always seeking to do, to destroy you and to isolate you from community. He comes to Jesus, and Jesus, in the end, casts the spirit out, in the end, throws it through the pigs. We can talk about that. We always get very upset about the little piggies, but we can chat about that if you like. But here's the interesting thing about this exorcism. A little bit like the thing about the calming of the storm, what's missing in the exorcism? We have many, many stories and accounts of exorcisms from the ancient world and the modern world. And what is always present, and you can see this in the life of Muhammad, when Muhammad himself is oppressed by evil spirits at one stage in a way that, so he himself goes into fasting and prayer, etc. What they always do is they always call on a higher power. Always. That's what exorcists do. And what various occultists do, they try to find the best, highest power. How high up in the great chain of being you can go. So Jewish exorcists do it. They call on God. Other people call on different things. The interesting thing with Jesus is there's no calling on any higher power. Now, it's just worth noting this. This is without parallel, as far as we know, from the ancient world. Jesus seems to think he has the power, not only to control the wildness of the waves, but also to control the wildness of specific, personal, powerful evil. And he thinks that his word alone shall do. This is, as I suggest to you, without parallel. One of the things that has been increasingly, I've been noting and I've been mentioning it, sharing it here a few times, is the utter weirdness of Jesus. When people just say he's like all the other, that is always an ignorant comment, often picked up from a book written by an ignorant man or woman. He's simply not. There is no one does, even no group of disciples even claim that their man can calm the storm and the sea. It's a self-evident nonsense. No one makes up that sort of story. It's unbelievable. Why did the first Christians believe it? Well, because they saw it. Why do they have this guy who... And interestingly enough, the New Testament never draws attention to it. It just records the fact that Jesus, unlike everybody else, doesn't call on anyone for help, but he releases the man from that terrible power. He then moves on to heal the woman who has been sick for 12 years. It starts in verse 25. We're told about this woman. She comes along and she's been sick for 12 years. I love the comment in verse 26. When Luke tells us this story, some of you will know this. Luke was a doctor. When Luke tells us the story of this woman, he leaves out this little background note, sort of professional solidarity. But Mark tells us she had suffered a great deal. This is verse 26. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. It sounds like one of my daughters. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Right? So Luke, I think, you don't say that about your colleagues. But you'll know people like this who've been sick for years and years. They've been seeing doctors one of my daughters is in this situation, not for 12 years. And frankly, sometimes the doctors are just disgracefully incompetent in the way that they don't answer her questions and don't pursue things through, and sometimes they just get it wrong. It's very frustrating as you see your life ebbing away. This is what this woman is like for 12 years. She touches Jesus and is well. Now, this is the first thing like this. There's no indication anywhere that simply touching Jesus brings you healing. But she's heard about him and she thinks, if I can just touch him. She's not actually supposed to be out in social life. She's bleeding regularly. She's therefore ritually and socially unclean. But she takes a punt and is healed. And Jesus says to her in verse 34, it's a beautiful statement, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Be freed from your suffering." Peace is again the word we looked at a few weeks ago, shalom. That sense of physical and psychological and relational well-being. It's not just the absence of war. You can have the absence of war and not be in shalom. You can be quite wealthy and well-loved and not be in shalom. Shalom is that deep wellness that right down to the marrow of your bones, the Bible will say. So Jesus meets the terrors of evil. He meets the power of the storm. He meets an incurable illness and in a moment cures it. Then he's off to heal this young girl who's on the brink of death. And he wastes all this time with this woman, chatting with her and talking with her. And then we get in verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader, and said, "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" This is one of those sandwich stories. We meet Jairus, who's concerned about his little girl who's dying. It's a tragedy. Tries to get Jesus to come. He says yes. Then we have another sickness story in the middle of a woman as well. She's sick for 12 years. The little girl is 12 years old. It's a nice little bit of parallelism that's going on. So we start with the sandwich, Jairus and his daughter, the woman in the middle, and then it finishes with the healing in the second part. This is the second time we've met one of these little, what they call Markan sandwiches. See what they say about Jesus? It's an impossible thing again for Jesus. The storm was impossible. No one could control that sick man. No one could heal the sick woman. Now, don't bother Jesus anymore. She's dead. You know, he might have been able to heal her, but he can't beat death. No one can beat death. Death beats us all. We have all those women's weekly articles and things like that about someone's, you know, someone beating death because they drove cancer back for a few. It's always baloney. The best you can do is delay the appointment. Death always finds us. Death always defeats us. No matter how powerful, how sick, how weak, how famous, death beats us all. It's the last great enemy. And one of the marks of our society is our complete cowardice to face it. I think the young wealthy men a couple of hundred years ago who would have a skull on their desk, which we just think is unspeakably morbid, is quite shrewd. And it would sometimes have under it, it was rich kids who did it. It would sometimes have under it, as you are, I once was, as I am, you soon will be. And it was actually to remind them of this great certainty rather than live in denial and foolishness. They say, don't bother him. This is out of his league. He's a great teacher. He's a great healer, but he can't beat death. No one can beat death. Jesus says to Jairus, verse 36, don't be afraid, just trust me, just believe. Again, it's the contrasting fear and belief. He then walks in, love to tell the story, but we don't have time. He says, Talitha kum, it's one of the four times when Jesus' Aramaic words are actually recorded for us. It had such an impact on the hearers, they couldn't forget it. One of my friend's daughters is called Talitha, which he got from this. Talitha kum is the words that a kindly mother would say to their daughter. It means, little girl, time to get up. You know, the afternoon nap is over. Your sleep is over. It's time to get up. And so hard is it for Jesus to wake a dead person up. That's what he says. The little girl gets up, and it says people were greatly astonished, as they should be. When Jesus said that the little girl was just sleeping, he was laughed at and mocked at. The Jews knew what death was as much as we do. He raised her up. Now, just in terms of how this deals with the question of anxiety, the big question behind all this is in chapter 4, verse 41, where the guys say, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. As I mentioned, one way to deal with anxiety is to try and dismiss the seriousness of the problem. It's a form of thoughtful denial, to say it doesn't matter, it's all small stuff, don't sweat the small stuff. The other way that Jesus, of course it's not small stuff. Little girls being sick is not small. Living with an illness for 12 years is not small. Being inhabited and taken over by evil is not a small thing. To be in a boat where you're about to drown or in a flood or in a bushfire, these are not small things. That is one way to deal with it psychologically. The other way is to say, these are terribly frightening things. Is there anyone more powerful? I've shared with some of you in a different context, I think, the time when my brother was walking down the back streets in King's Cross back in the late 60s. He was drunk. He'd met a guy that day enrolling at Sydney University in dentistry. He knew little about him, but they were walking through and suddenly these three or four guys jumped out in front of them, and Ross said they didn't look as if they were from the Salvation Army there to help. My brother, being an Australian male, was not frightened. He might have been a tad anxious. He was scared witless. He was a Rose Bay boy after all, and they don't breed him very tough in Rose Bay. But at this point, Ross's friend put his arm across Ross's chest and said, leave this to me, Ross. And Ross said there was just a confidence about the guy. And the guy walked calmly in the middle of the four or five guys. It was like a Bruce Lee movie. And within a few seconds, they were all lying on the ground groaning. And Ross picked his way through going, you know, like triumphing. Now, he said suddenly he learned something about his friend. He knew the guy was good fun, he was good to be with, to go to nightclubs. But suddenly he realized this man had a power that he was unaware of. And Ross felt very confident in his presence. But he was unlikely to pick a fight with his friend. I saw his friend on television smashing tiles and things with his hands and with his head, and that's probably why he didn't finish dentistry either, which my brother didn't do. But that is the sort of mechanism that the Bible is saying. There is someone more powerful than these things that we are rightly frightened of. And the question is to bring that thing that frightens us or makes us anxious into the direct presence of that person much more powerful. It's one of the reasons why one of the repeated artworks in the early church in the catacombs when the early Christians were hiding and burying their dead when they were being persecuted is a small ship in a storm with Jesus in the boat, echoing this. Because the experience of the early Christians was of tremendous reasons for being anxious. To become Christian then increased your reasons to fear. Because whatever other reasons you had, you are now often on, not continually, but often on, depending on the emperor and the local governor, the object of deadly opposition. And so they would draw this ship, saying, we are in stormy seas, but we are in the presence of someone who rules over all things. He does not do what I want him to do. So we're going to see in the next chapter that what looks as if it should be, wow, if Jesus has got power over nature, power over evil, power over chronic disease, power even over death, we should power onto Jerusalem, take over the world. No, Jesus says, it's a small seed. It's marked by suffering and death. But what he's saying is, you can trust me in this. You will suffer. You will go through the valley of the shadow of death. You will be caught up in terrifically stormy seas when everything is happening wrong at the one time, but you can trust this one. Fear is opposed to faith in Jesus. So the answer to our longing for peace is not, you know, various forms of denial or taking out more insurance policies, etc. But it's a person. And it's a question of knowing that person. Now, I have a key to my unit in Camperdown. It doesn't seem to go in first time every time. But I do know that's the key. I know it's quite distinctive in its look. And sometimes I fiddle around and I think, what the heck's wrong with this? And this is the key in the end to dealing with our enduring battle with anxiety that will go on until the day that we breathe our last in this world. Let me read you and finish on this. This is a quite famous poem. It's not the world's greatest poetry. It was introduced to most of the English world and the Australians, and it became a favourite of the Queen Mother who died recently, and it was actually written on the chapel in which she normally prayed. And it was read by George VI in his first Christmas address to the Empire after World War II had been declared. Okay, and it says this. I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown. He replied, go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way. So I went forth, and finding the hand of God, I trod gladly into the night. And so my heart be still, and on it goes. That, I think, is the answer to anxiety. It's knowing that one, seeing his power, and then thinking through our numerous fears in the light of him and having him in the boat with us. Well, I'll be quiet there so there's some time for further questions. Okay, folks. First question. Did Jesus have to transfer the demons from Legion to the pigs, affecting the livelihood of quite a few who were apparently innocent? That is a good question. Did he have to? I presume not. Could he have done something else? I presume so. Why did he do it? No idea, really. I used to think the answer to the question was partly, these are Jewish boys, they shouldn't have pigs. But this is actually in the area of the lake he's gone to, as far as we can tell from history, was predominantly non-Jews. So it was okay for them to eat pigs. I don't understand. I mean, I'm more sympathetic when people are concerned about the piggies dying if they're vegetarians. I'm always a little suspicious when people are happy to eat them, But look, I don't know. It's a weird miracle. It's without parallel. It's without explanation. I think what it does do, though, it does show the anxiety of the spirits. And I don't actually know what all this means. The anxiety of the spirits to remain, firstly, in an area. They ask not to be sent from the area. You'll notice they are the ones who appeal to higher authority. Unlike the normally the exorcist appeals to higher authority, it's the demons who say, we adjure you by God, don't torture us. You know, so that it's the demons who are frightened in the presence of Jesus, completely unlike the movies. I've been involved in one or two exorcisms, that's all, and I've talked with people who've been involved in a few, and they're remarkably unexciting, I'm sorry. The authority of Jesus is simply overwhelming in that situation. But the spirits don't want to be disembodied for some reason. They would rather be in the pigs. I think it may be showing that they would, you know, they would rather be in a grotty animal, quoting Pulp Fiction, they're a dirty animal, but than be nowhere. It also shows us the end goal always of evil. The end goal of evil. It always comes beautifully dressed, offering you a sort of a Faustian bargain, I'll give you this, this, and this. But the end goal of evil is always destruction. But I don't actually know why. Frankly, I'd prefer if Jesus had done something different. But he is, as I mentioned, he is unscripted. He will do what he flipping well likes. And as you've heard me say often, I don't think my inability to be able to nut it all out means that there is no good reason. I have no idea why my computer doesn't work. I know there is a good reason. Well, I know there's a reason. But me not knowing it is not the same thing as saying there's no reason. And because of what I know about God, particularly in Jesus, his love, his power, his willingness to die for us, his love of even of his enemies, I'm happy to trust him even though I don't really know. No, because I think the pigs have no capacity to resist. But I don't want to move into too much speculation because we know sort of 1% of anything about what evil spirits do. It's a bit like the question of suffering. What the Bible tells you is how to deal with it rather than many of the theoretical questions I'd like to have answers. Now, there's a series of questions here which are in the area of anxiety more. Should a genuine Christian never be subject to debilitating anxiety that many seem to experience? I'm not an expert on it. There's no doubt from my experience and many people I've known that applying the reality of the power of Jesus to our specific situation, which takes some level of mental discipline, just to think my way through. It's a bit like the way that I used to deal with my fear of going under the Harbour Bridge when I was a kid. I'd go, you know, I used to think, this is going to fall on me. I'm going to die. And I would reason with myself saying, it stood for 40 years. What are the chances of it falling in these few seconds? You know, so you deal with your fears rationally. You address your fears. So I think what the Bible's urge is to take what we know about God and bring this fear situation together. What's happening in all the stories is people are getting in touch with Jesus. The sailors are crying out to him, etc., etc. I think that there may well be a chemical. Is that trying to tell me to shut up? It may well be, and there seems to be evidence that for some people it's a chemical thing, that there are questions of serotonin and other chemicals that help the mind function well. And it may be that some people, in the same way some people need to take their insulin because they simply don't produce enough of it, it may well be some people need that. I would think if someone is caught up in the extremities of anxiety over a long period of time, they should seek counsel from wise Christians who may well then have wise doctors that can help at least look at the question of the physiological side. But there's no doubt that that anxiety is, I think it's an ongoing issue for all humans until we die, because life is a dangerous business and anxiety is a response to that sense of threat. A place of worship such as church buildings helpful to overcome anxiety? I think for many people they are helpful because they just enclose you in something and they cause you to focus on something. So I think sometimes if something helps you focus on the reality and power of Jesus, go there. Is the peace of God beyond all understanding? That's a quote, that's a question based on the famous verse from Philippians, the peace of God which passes all understanding, keep guard your hearts and minds. It's quite a powerful word. I think many people have had this experience of extraordinary peace at moments and they would not expect it. But there are instructions before that. If you want to go to Philippians 4, there are things said to do and not do. So it's not a magic. There's no magic in Christianity. But it's saying, do this, and the peace of God which passes. So if you don't read what precedes, you're unlikely to enjoy the peace that passes understanding. But I know at various times for many people, it comes almost out of the blue. But generally speaking, the Bible suggests, do what Philippians 4 says, and you will experience that peace. Lastly, anxiety. Are you saying that one good strategy for the anxious is to read the Gospels? Well, that was better put than I put it, so thank you for that question. Yes. I think the thing is it's like my brother. Realize the person who is with you. Face the thing that's frightening you, and then bring the two together, and there's someone with you who has loved you enough to die for you, who is more powerful than you can imagine, and in these stories keeps overwhelming new areas. You might say, gee, but there's no story of Jesus dealing with a savage boss who's undermining me, or a partner who's betrayed me in some way. Well, the same power and wisdom that Jesus shows here in new areas, he can well apply to other areas. But yes, I do think the old adage of turn your eyes upon Jesus is the way forward, and that's what the Gospels keep doing. People bring their fears and anxieties to Jesus, and he makes all the difference in the world. Well, have an anxiety-free week. And then.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.